Welcome to Hello Vancouver. I'm your host, Temple Lentz. We have got a fantastic show for you today. I'll be speaking with Clark County Councillor John Blom about a wide range of things that are going on at the county. I'll also be talking with Michelle Larson from the Joy Team, and we're going to start off with Vancouver City Councillor Jack Berkman talking about fireworks regulations. This is the very first year that Vancouver has banned all fireworks within the city limits, and Jack and I are going to talk about some of the penalties that you need to be aware of, where this decision came from, and what you need to know. Let's get started. I'm joined now by Vancouver City Councillor Jack Berkman, and we're going to talk about fireworks. So Jack, hi, thanks for joining me.
Hello, Temple. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I'm really happy that you're here to talk with us about fireworks. This show is going to be airing right before the 4th of July. And for folks who've been around Vancouver and Clark County for, well, pretty much any length of time at all, they know that fireworks has been a somewhat contentious issue over the last few years, with discussion of banning them, limitations on sale, people getting upset about the fireworks going off in the county. And this year, for the first year ever, we have a ban on fireworks in Vancouver.
That's correct. Year after year, the Vancouver Council, like a lot of other communities, has made changes to the fireworks law. So it's really worthwhile that people follow what's going on. And this year, it really is completely banned on fireworks.
And so a complete ban means on not just on July 4th, but at all, you're not allowed to set off fireworks within the city limits of Vancouver.
Correct. At no time during the year can you own fireworks or let off fireworks. Not on the 4th of July, not on 1st of January, not on today.
Now, that is within the city of Vancouver, but confusingly, other parts of the county and the area don't have this ban.
That's correct. They allow it in limited times. Every jurisdiction, it seems like, treats this differently.
Well, that's convenient, not confusing at all for those of us who just want to know what's going on.
Exactly. And because we have an urbanized area, sometimes it's hard to tell whether you're in the county or you're in the city.
Yeah. So like we are recording this interview right now in scenic Hazeldell, Washington, which is technically outside of the city limits. And we're just around the corner from one of the big outdoor fireworks sales areas that's just setting up. But they're outside city limits, so they're completely within the law. But if you go under the bridge and into the city of Vancouver with those fireworks, what kind of crime are you committing?
It's a violation of city law, and that carries a $500 fine for the first offense and goes up from there. Now, in order to help people understand this, the city has these nice, bright, greenish, I don't know what color you'd call that, fireworks law posters that are being put on all those stands that are just outside the city limits. So people can see and go, oh, wait a minute, yeah, Something's changed.
So the county is allowing very short sales. It's I believe it's June 28th through the 4th, or the day before the 4th.
Something like that, yeah.
But it doesn't really matter if you're in Vancouver. Now, where did that come from? What's the history of that decision on the city's part?
Well, like I say, this is a common issue among cities. More specifically, it's a common issue around any area that's developing and getting more houses and more people. And then when you talk about fireworks, you get into safety issues really quickly. And so you have to reach back over a decade, because back in 2005, the city council actually banned the sale and use of fireworks on New Year's Eve. So that was their first step. And then in 2008, they brought it from what was a week long to just 4 days of use of fireworks, 7 days of sale. And so you see, it just keeps tightening it up. And then in October 2015, the Vancouver City Council said, this still is not working. The only thing we can really see right now is let's just ban it. So by unanimous vote, that's what occurred. Now, there's a state law that says, well, you can't do anything for 365 days. The fireworks lobbyists are pretty powerful.
I was going to ask about that, because you said that this
this came to pass in October of 2015, and we're now in 2017. So
it just takes time. So that meant our law did not go into effect until October 2016. But most people don't realize that, and so they don't see it until right now, right before the 4th of July, when the advertising comes out for the fireworks and such.
So how heavily will this be enforced? I know that's been one of the questions over the years. You know, fireworks aren't allowed on this day or that day, but people are still setting them off. And there's, you know, it's like, well, you might get a slap on the wrist. Is this going to be enforced?
This is going to be enforced. It is a zero tolerance. There are not going to be warnings issued. People can call 311 to report them. I know there's going to be a number of violations. There always is. But most people are law-abiding. And the challenge here is to get the word to them. Most people want to follow the law. Some people say they don't. And there's a pretty heavy consequence if they choose not to do that and an officer rolls up, because it's also possession, not just launching the firework.
Wow.
Yes.
There are probably a number of people who are hearing this for the first time right now, or at least registering it for the first time right now and reevaluating their plans. So fireworks is a it's an issue that people get very passionate about here. I recall over the last number of years, as the city was thinking and talking about this in 14, 15, 16, you know, folks coming to testify to council and feeling very strongly on both sides of the issue. Can you tell me a little bit about the process as a city councilor of navigating that and determining how you received public input that was so divided?
You're right. This is a polarizing issue. And there's a group of people that say, well, it's obvious we should have fireworks. That's what the majority want. This is vocal minority. And then there's other group that says, well, clearly we've got to get rid of them. And the others are just a vocal minority. And then when we would have a hearing and talk about this, the room would get packed and you could almost draw a line down the middle of the room.
Yeah.
You know, one side was for and another side was against. And I don't think that's unusual. This is a passionate issue. Some people associated with liberty, U.S. rights, personal freedoms, some people associated with danger, with PTSD veterans and the impact on them and animals. And so those are all really personalized issues.
Yeah. Now, is it something that the council will be discussing after the 4th to talk, you know, to revisit how it went and talk about lessons learned or what can be improved?
I'm sure that that will happen because every year the council reviews what happened the previous year. And that's part of what got us into this, too, because while there was a time when we had real high fire danger, we still had a number of incidents. And each year we kept getting more and more incidents, more damage, bringing property damage up into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I think that's why actually it's pretty common now in the state of Washington to be banning fireworks. And I don't think a lot of people realize that, that Vancouver is really far behind what other cities have done, because as of today, there are 8 counties and 76 cities in the state of Washington that ban fireworks. Matter of fact, if you look at the top 13 largest cities in Washington, they all ban.
Oh, wow.
This is a common issue as cities get bigger. Smaller cities, they have some flexibility.
Yeah. So you said that's the top 13 cities in the state.
Yes.
And we're the fourth largest city, aren't we?
Correct.
So, well, there you go.
And even as you reach down to the top 20, 25, you're still going to find the vast majority of them are banning. And even those cities are still looking at what to do next. When we had our hearings in October 2015, there were 65 cities. Now there's 76. There were 6 counties. Now there are 8. So I think this is a really common discussion point of how do you provide safety for your city.
So the items that are banned are the things that are really classified as fireworks. These aren't the sparklers you can buy at the grocery store or things like that.
Well, funny you'd mention sparklers. I got myself in kind of a pickle on that one because they said, oh, you know, sparklers should not be a problem. Well, I quickly learned that they're actually one of the most dangerous ones.
Oh.
And most of the damage to people occurs because of sparklers, high temperature.
Well, sure. I've been burned by
yeah,
exactly.
I remember this well.
So are sparklers banned as well?
Yes, they are.
Oh.
So there's a category called novelty fireworks. It'll pop at you, throw on the ground, those kind of things. Those are not, because it's not legally classified as a firework. And again, this is where some of the confusion occurs, because firecrackers, things that go boom, have been outlawed in the city of Vancouver for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
That's also how you get into a ban in a city, because people aren't sure what's allowed, what's not, when, and it becomes almost impossible to communicate it and enforce it. There's a city website page that has a lot of good information on it, and it says that sparklers accounted for 28% of the fireworks-related injuries in 2014.
Oh, wow.
And 79% of the fireworks injuries in that year fell into categories of sparklers, firecrackers, reloadable shells, and novelty fireworks. So it's not necessarily the big fireworks that people think are coming from the reservations. People are harming themselves and property with what I would call regular old fireworks.
Hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to see how it goes this year, and hopefully the police and fire aren't too overtaxed, and folks are aware of this early enough to avoid a $500 ticket.
Well, and thank you so much for having me on the show, because we really want to get the word out. Again, I really believe that most people want to follow the law. They just need to know what it is. And so that's why the city has embarked on a very heavy education campaign. You're going to see reader boards up. You're going to see signs around. It's on the website. It's on social media. Everything the city can think of to get the word out. So we're not surprising people.
Excellent. And so if folks want to go to the city's website to read the information you're talking about, where should they go?
Just go to cityofvancouver.us. And as soon as you go to that website, you will find a number of links on the front page. Just look for something that says fireworks, or down at the bottom will be one called current issues, and it should be listed right there.
Excellent. Well, Vancouver City Councilor Jack Berkman, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk with us about fireworks today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Temple.
So I'm here today with Michelle Larson, who is the head of the Joy Team. And the Joy Team, I'm going to let Michelle actually tell you what they do, but in general, they bring joy to our world. So welcome, Michelle. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yay! Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Many people will know about the Joy Team because of the bright yellow billboards that they might see around town. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do and about those billboards?
Yeah. So we are a 501c3. We're a registered nonprofit with the IRS, and we're a positive thought organization. So our entire mission is just to spread joy, optimism, and inspiration to millions of people.
You know, it seems more and more that we could use that on a regular basis.
I think so. I think we could. It's a good thing. Yeah. So when we started, we founded the organization just with the idea of putting up billboards. And that was all that we were planning to do, was put up positive messages on these big bright yellow billboards to spread some joy into the world. And since then, we've added lots of other little projects and programs, and have grown quite a bit.
So some of these, what are some of the messages that people will see on the billboards? I'm betting if you don't know what we're talking about, as soon as we describe it to you, you'll see one, and now you'll see them everywhere. Because yeah, that's when I first found out about them. I suddenly started seeing them everywhere. They're fantastic.
Thank you. I love them. Yeah, they make you happy. It's hard not to smile when you see them, because they are bright yellow, which is very eye-catching. And then they say things like, think happy thoughts, or you got this, and bonus, you look amazing today.
I love that one. I know. I go by that one, and I'm like, I'm going to change my route just so I can see that one today.
I know. I love that one, too. Some of them are very fun and whimsical like that. And others of them are a little more serious, like you make a difference, or you are worthy of everything. So it kind of runs the gamut between, you know, fun and silly, and things that are really meant to reach you on a deeper level and affirm your value and worth of as a human being.
What made you decide that this was something you wanted to commit this time and energy and resources to?
Yeah, you know, like with probably a lot of things that you have started in your life, you don't always know what they're going to entail when you get started, right? You think, you know, I just wanted to put some happy messages out into the world. And so when I started, you know, actually my daughter and I started originally with just making some little quotes on pieces of paper, and we laminated them and we sprinkled them around. That was great. But then, you know, that was 75 little cards. And then if, you know, half of them didn't get tossed into the gutter before someone found them, or swept up by, you know, a custodian before getting picked up and actually reaching somebody's eyeballs, we reached 75 people, maybe, right? But with a billboard, one message can reach hundreds of thousands of eyeballs. in a 4-week period. So it seemed like a great thing to do. And I gathered some friends and family together and I said, hey, I want to put these happy messages on billboards and I need some money to do it. And they said, okay. Yeah.
And so what are some of the partnerships that you've done to do this? Because it doesn't seem like this is a very strong revenue generating activity.
No, we have no paid staff at the Joy Team. It's all volunteer based and volunteer run. And so all of the donations that we receive go straight into things like billboards or the PB and Joy Project or other projects and programs that are spreading joy. So they are supported by all kinds of people, mostly small businesses, and some people who are just families that want to think it's a really cool and fun thing to do and they want to do it. So we have some individuals and families that have supported billboards or sponsored them just because they think it's really cool. And then some people who are businesses who are doing it and, you know, you get some marketing benefit from it, but mostly it's the billboard is about the message with just a little place for your logo down there. So it's mostly about the spreading joy and kindness and optimism.
Nice.
Yeah.
So where are they?
So we, they are basically anywhere billboards are not necessarily sold. So we have, we always have two up, at any given time, at least in the Portland-Vancouver Metro. And often we have more than that because they are what we call PSAs, public service announcements. They sometimes will stay up for months in the same location if that billboard isn't sold for a retail customer.
Ah, okay. So it's like an arrangement with the billboard company where if they have the open space, they'll take one of your billboards and put it up during that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ah, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, they're really nice. And I don't even know where they all are sometimes because I don't always, you know, they don't always tell me when they're using what we call a cover copy to put up in places. So if I haven't arranged for like a guaranteed spot, they may show up and I don't know where they are. So I always encourage people to take pictures and text me or post them to Facebook and tell me where they are so I can go find them.
Now, you mentioned the PB and Joy Project, and I know a little bit about that, but I'm not sure if listeners do. So can you tell me what that is?
Yeah, it's my kids went to Hauk Elementary, which is, you know, right in the heart of downtown Vancouver. And I got to learn about this wonderful thing that Share does called the Backpack Program, which I think is probably in every community across America.
Yeah. And Share is a nonprofit that helps the homeless and hungry.
Yep. Yeah, and they work with a lot of food issues and kinds of things. They're an amazing organization.
They really are. And this backpack program, yeah, it is in a lot of different communities and it's really fantastic. It's where basically Cher will fill a backpack with food for the weekend and let kids take it home. You know, in our Vancouver school district, I just heard some of these statistics lately. Vancouver is a little better than Evergreen, but not much. The Evergreen school district is at 47% of children are on the free and reduced price lunch
program.
Yeah, that's up from like 37% 10 years ago.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it's a lot of kids. A lot of families are really struggling in Vancouver and Clark County.
Wow.
Yeah.
The last numbers I heard were 1 in 4, which is only 25%.
Yeah.
So,
and it varies, you know, it's free and reduced. I mean, there are kids who qualify for free lunch and there's kids who qualify for reduced, but no matter what, these are families that are struggling.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think my numbers might be food insecurity, which may be a little more strenuous than just free and reduced lunches.
Right. And so for the kids who are in some of the direst need, you know, they're able to come to school and get their breakfast and their lunch, but then they go home for the weekend and there may be no food in the house.
Yeah.
So this backpack, the Share and the Share volunteers fill it with healthy food for them to take home and the kids
every
and their
Friday.
Families can eat it over the weekend.
Yeah, every Friday. And there's always one protein in this backpack. They vary the food and I think it's roughly every fourth bag once a month or so gets filled with peanut butter as the protein. And so I just was really touched by the situation of so many kids being hungry. I want to do something about it, but there's already so many people helping with hunger mm-hmm. out there, and our mission is purely about spreading joy and optimism. So I kind of shimmied around that a little bit by wrapping these donated peanut butter jars with positive messages. We had our Junior Joy team write out some really cool positive messages, inspiring messages, and created labels with them on there so that when we get donations of 18-ounce plastic jars of peanut butter, we wrap them with these labels and take them to share. And so when they go home with the kids, they have not only some food for their belly, but some food for their heart and their souls, too.
So about how many jars of peanut butter do you donate and put into the bags every month, week, year?
We're now at over 4,000 jars in total. It varies depending on what kind of donations we get in with a peanut butter, and we haven't been doing a very good job of promoting that program. So our peanut butter donations have dwindled. So we're not doing as much as we would like to.
Well, if somebody wanted to get in touch, so people can donate direct peanut butter, or they could conceivably, I would guess, donate money to go buy peanut butter.
Yeah, they can make a donation and say, hey, this is for the PB and Joy project, and I will use all that money to go buy peanut butter for the program.
Fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. What I think we really need is we need a place, because we are, run out of my living room, right? There's not an easy place for people to bring things. So there's a box at First and Berg that gets filled. And for a while we had a Rotary group that was bringing boxes that they'd collect from their members and putting them on my doorstep. So, which is really, really sweet. They've done it for like 2 years. It's amazing. But I think if we could find partners that have retail locations that are easy for people to go and drop jars that would, host a box somewhere, that might make it easier for people to participate in the program.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, if anyone's out there who has a location that we could stock with some boxes and collect peanut butter, that'd be great.
Your website is thejoyteam.org. Mm-hmm. That's all spelled out, The Joy Team. And then specifically for the PB and Joy project, it's PB and, spelled out, and joy. So PB and Joy project.org. And they could reach you through those websites if anybody wanted to donate peanut butter, donate locations, get involved.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My email is Michelle at the Joy Team with one L. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So you can reach out to us through those channels as well at the Joy Team.
So tell me now about, you have an event in August called Chalk the Walks. What the heck is Chalk the Walks?
I love this program. It is so much fun. So after we started with the organization and putting it billboards, I thought, billboards are awesome, but it's hard to get a whole lot of individual engagement in them, right? Because you have to, they're can be a little expensive. So my daughter and my son were out one day writing stuff on the driveway with chalk. And then I thought, oh, that is such an easy thing to do. We should do a day where people can chalk positive messages and share them with everyone, right? So, because you can go to the dollar store and get chalk for a buck. Right. So anybody can participate in a Chalk the Walks program. So we started on Facebook in, I think, 2011. And you just from wherever you are at any time of the day on the third Tuesday in August, we always hold it on the third Tuesday in August. You chalk a positive message on your sidewalk or your driveway or in front of your store. We happen to be doing it on Main Street in Vancouver. So and then you take a Facebook or a picture of it and post it on the Facebook page. And people from all over the world are doing it. We had almost 38,000 people last year doing it.
Oh, my gosh.
Worldwide. Yeah. It's been quite an adventure.
That is really cool.
So you can see somebody posting from Australia or Mexico or the Netherlands or Buffalo, New York, as you're scrolling through the Facebook event page and you post your photo there. And it's wonderful because people literally scroll through and will like and comment on other people's chalk art. It's really awesome.
Oh, that is neat. And so Chalk the Walks, you'll have a Facebook event for it and people can find that through your Facebook page?
Yep, it's already up. So it's Chalk the Walks on Facebook with an S. Some people forget the S on the end. So it's Chalk the Walks, plural. And there's a Facebook event on the Facebook page for Chalk the Walks.
Okay.
And it's up and running, and you just join in, and we'll send out reminders as we get closer to the event, and then you can scroll through and look at all the wonderful pictures. And some people post pictures now that are just like, you know,
I just did this
practice run. Yeah,
so that's really cool. Yeah, and that's just a fun thing. I know that like I've liked going downtown on the day of just to sort of wander through and see what folks have written, and sometimes people are still there, so you can chat with them when they're writing their message. And
yeah, it's really neat. And we have several groups of people that gather. So, like actually, this has fallen the day before school starts in Alaska for a lot of schools. So for the last several years, the United Way in Alaska, I think in Anchorage maybe, has gathered a bunch of people, and they've gone to several schools in their town and had chalking parties for Chalk the Walks to welcome the kids back to school. Last year we had a gal who spends a lot of time at a children's hospital back east, and it happened to be on her birthday. And so she wanted to chalk the walks for her birthday and got the hospital to hold an event for her, and they had thousands of chalk donations, and a lot of the kids who were well enough got to go out to the little square and chalk happy messages for the day. It was really, really neat.
Oh, that is incredibly
cool. Little things like that happen all over. It's really a wonderful, happy, joyful, and very simple but powerful event.
And it's nice to have something. It's, you know, in a time when it seems like everything that we do has to, you know, turn a profit or meet a deadline or hit some other bar, it's really nice to hear about things that are just being done to make us happier, to make us a little better, to just bring a little bit of joy to the world. So thank you for being here, and thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
And leading that effort to just bring a smile.
Thank you. Well, it makes me very happy to do it. I get so much pleasure out of doing it myself. So
excellent. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And I'm sure we will talk to you soon when there's something else joyful to talk about.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you, Temple.
Thank you. So a lot of politicians force you to meet them in their office or come to them once they get into office. But a really good one gets out into the community. And I am really happy to be sitting here today outside of the studio, outside of the office, talking with County Councilor John Blom. Hi, John.
Hey, Temple.
So thanks for joining me. And we are here in downtown Vancouver at Trapdoor Brewing. And we're going to just have a conversation about what's going on with the county. Now, John, you were just elected last fall, and so you've been in office now for about 6 months. How's it going?
I had the fortune of coming into the county council with 3 years in the planning commission, and I really do believe that that was great experience and great training for being on the council. But there's so many more things that the county is involved in outside of land use. Land use is certainly a big part of it, but just this morning we had a work session on the Southwest Recovery Coalition, it's a group of volunteers. The county has some role in of helping people deal with recovery, which that ties into mental health challenges and our homelessness challenges. So many things touch other aspects, and then the county kind of has its hand in all of those. So I think that's been kind of the big learning curve. Is 1 week we have to be an expert on recovery and drug and alcohol treatment, kind of plays a role in that. And the next week we might be talking about our forestry plan. And then the week after that, our transportation plan. So you kind of have to be an expert in all things, or at least know enough to get through.
Well, it means you're probably not getting bored on a day-to-day basis.
No, boredom is not an issue.
Now, if we can just jump into it, though, you're talking about this recovery plan, and I think that's really interesting. What is the county's role in something like assisting recovery in the community?
So with this particular coalition, we're really just kind of a supportive of helping bring together the key players. And they do the bulk of the work. The county, through public health, plays a supporting role. So it's bringing together the faith community. Some of our nonprofit service providers, Lifeline, plays a big part in that. But it's kind of a value add for the services that the county provides. There are certain things that we're mandated that we have to do. But by having these, one of the big things they do is have recovery coaches that kind of come alongside and, you know, they're not there. They're not the therapist. They're not the clinician. But they're just that person who's there when someone's recovering from addiction and needs some help, that can be there and kind of help them along. So by leveraging these volunteers, we're able to, you know, go further with the taxpayers' dollars and the things that we are mandated to provide and that we should be providing. Before I served in the council, I served on the board for Columbia River Mental Health Services for a number of years. And one of the things I took out of that experience is we are viewing recovery more as a chronic illness and less of an acute illness. And this came up in the work session with the Recovery Coalition today, that, you know, you don't just take someone, put them in 21-day rehab, and now they're fixed. You know, the example that came out of the Recovery Coalition today was, you know, it's like dental care. If you have a tooth that needs a filling, you don't just go and get it filled, and now you never need to see the dentist again for the rest of your life. It's something that you're going to be constantly doing. And that's true for many of these people, you know, whatever the addiction was. Particularly with opiates, there's actually chemistry in your body that changes when someone has an opioid addiction. And when Dr. Melnick came, who's the public health director, when he came and talked to the Columbia River Board, he said, you know, we need to think about opiate addiction in the same way that we think about diabetes, that you would never expect a diabetic to be cured and get off their insulin. In the same way, once someone has that addiction, it's always going to be a part of them. And so we need to be supportive and really changing the stigma of, if you're in recovery, it's not you're never 100% better. You're always in recovery for the rest of your life. And we need to embrace that and support that and give those people, you know, not make them feel like they're stigmatized because they've had this challenge in their past.
So one of the other things that has been in the news recently for the county was the fact that the county manager, Mark McCauley's contract wasn't renewed. And McCauley had been county manager instituted by the charter. And then the council met and decided not to renew his contract. One of the reasons that was given for that decision was that the county wants to go in a different direction. Can you talk a little bit about what was wrong with the direction that it was going in the first place, and what's the new direction?
I think we're at a real crossroads for our community, for our region. You know, as I was driving here from the county building, driving past a 6-story apartment complex in Uptown Village, you know, in our board time today, looking out the window, seeing construction going on at the waterfront. This is a booming time, not just for City of Vancouver, but for Clark County. So I think we're going to see the council take a real hard look at economic development over the next. We're looking at it in two ways. One is kind of the short term. How do we improve our permitting process to be able to get projects through that more quickly so that those companies can move here and create jobs, so that more housing can be built? You know, there's a huge challenge with affordable housing right now, kind of at every point on the spectrum. So I think economic development in the short term with that permitting process, but then also coming up with a vision of what do we want Clark County to look like. Development and growth is going to happen, you know, like it or not. We can either be reactive to it, or we can sit back, take a step back, and say, what's our vision? What kind of companies do we want to try and recruit? How can we work with the CREDC to target the right kind of industries that match the workforce that we have here? How do we plan for and build the infrastructure that we need to grow that? So it's taking that long-term vision and really being proactive in that. Mark was a fantastic manager in bringing the county through some really difficult times. And the whole community, I think, owes him a debt of gratitude for the work that he put in over the last 2 or 3 years.
So you're putting out an RFP for a new manager. What will you be looking for in that position?
I think vision is going to be at the top of the list. Someone that is going to come in and be very proactive in terms of engaging with the counselors to come up with a vision and be a partner in creating that. It's an incredibly difficult position to fulfill because you are essentially you are the CEO of a 1,700 person organization, and you have great department heads. But the county, and now this kind of ties back into what we said at the beginning, the county does so much. You know, if you're a CEO in most companies, your company has kind of a very specific function or role that you do, and you also get to pick who your customers are to a certain extent. The county doesn't get to necessarily pick everything that it does. You know, we probably don't necessarily and always want to be in the, you know, some of the industries that we have to be in. Not a lot of money being made in the coroner's office, but that's a function of county government. So we have to be there. You know, we work in mental health. That's a really difficult population to serve, but it's a critical and core function. So we have to be doing those things. So we have to have the county manager has to be able to do all of those things, work with public works and building roads, look at building parks, doing public health, doing mental health. We have interaction with our schools. So much happens that person not only has to have the management skills to handle an organization of that size and a budget that's, you know, close to $1 billion, but then also have enough knowledge in all those areas to really be effective in guiding the county.
And you have a 5-person council, and after the charter was implemented a couple of years ago, the council went from a combined executive and legislative function to legislative overall, which means setting the policy. So what role does the council have in determining and setting forward the vision for the county?
I think that's really an important role that isn't necessarily spelled out in the charter, but in terms of what kind of policy the council creates, that vision plays a huge role. Now, you said there's 5 of us, which means there's potentially 5 different visions. So it's finding that overlap to move that forward, but then be able to take the next step in turning that vision into reality by working with staff to come up with the right policies to meet the goals that we share. I think one of the interesting challenges I've observed over the last 6 months, last year one of the common questions in the campaign was, what do you think about the charter and how could it be changed? And at the time, I didn't really have a great answer for that. I said, you know what, let me do the job, elect me, and then I'll tell you how I think it could be changed. I think if there is a weakness in the charter, you've created a legislative body that essentially has no support. So if you look at like the legislature in Olympia, there's a pretty significant staff in, you know, both caucuses, Republican and Democratic caucus. Then you also have the nonpartisan staff that's supporting up there. All of our staff is under the executive here through the county executive. So for example, I'm working on some housing things. I hope we're going to talk about that in a little bit here. But even just to have the authority to start working with staff on this, I had to go to the council and get 3 votes to say, okay, am I allowed to work with staff to put this together? Because we've created this distinction. So you almost have to get a majority just to support the general idea of working on something, you know, as opposed to in Olympia or in Washington, D.C., if the legislature has an idea, they can work with their staff or with lobbyists or with, you know, interest groups to craft whatever legislation might need to be introduced. Unless we're just going to sit down and try and write code or write county policy for ourselves, which I'm not qualified to do. I don't think any other counselors, you know, we don't have that training for writing, you know, county code. You almost have to get permission to even start having the idea, and then you have to get the actual votes to pass the idea. So I think it has made it a little bit difficult to do anything or to do much.
I think that's a really interesting point. And one of the things when the charter was being drafted, and full disclosure, I was one of the freeholders who did help draft that charter.
I hold you responsible for most of what's wrong with it.
I think only the things that are wrong with it. Everything right was somebody else, probably Joe Zarelli. But no, so in drafting the charter, which was an interesting process, because talking about having to come together with different opinions to try to find consensus and get something that then we could get a majority of voters to approve, a lot of things are coming up like, oh, this is a changeable document. This is a work in progress, and we can refine it just as we refine our government and our legislation. So is the council working on trying to put forward a way to amend that, a way to make the case for this is a change we could make?
Right now, I think we're trying to work within the system that we have to figure out how do we do this. And I think that's going to be one of the big asks of a new county manager is, how do we have a process so that when we have an initiative that we want to see get through, what's the process for doing that? And so we are five individual counselors, and we all have our different priorities. We need to have a more effective way of moving those priorities forward to bring in a product to the council, so the council can do its legislative authority of approving, amending, passing, rejecting those pieces of essentially legislation.
And one of the things that I've been hearing out in the community is that there is a possible desire to do further amendments to the charter on taking the executive roles and the council roles. So there's the elected council, and then there are also the executive offices, the auditor, the assessor, the treasurer, taking those offices and putting on the ballot to make them nonpartisan. There's been some talk about that possibly being a way to help take some of the politics out of politics. How do you feel about that?
I think so much of what the county government does is truly nonpartisan. My wife teaches middle school, and I had the opportunity to go and talk to them about county government. And the first question I asked them was, how many of you have had interaction with county government in the last week? And none of them raised their hands. So I asked them, okay, how many of you ate at a restaurant in the last week? 75% of kids raise their hand. Like, you know what? County health inspector checked all of those restaurants. How many of you went to a park or drove on a road? Odds are, based on where the school was, they were outside of the city, so they were on a county road playing at a county park. How many walked on a sidewalk? All the things that county government does, not a whole lot of partisan role in that. I think it was, I forget who it was that told me this. Someone said, you know what, a sidewalk doesn't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. So I think there's a lot of merit to looking at moving the positions to nonpartisan. But the great thing about the charter is it's going to be up to the people. So if that idea gets put forward, there will be a lively debate, I'm sure, and there'll be people with strong opinions on both sides, and ultimately the people will decide.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier was that you're working on some things with housing. Now, we know that in the Northwest in general, especially the Portland-Vancouver metro area, there is not enough affordable housing. We have a homeless problem as well as an affordable housing problem. What is the county doing now to start to remedy this?
So I'd say my focus right now, I can't speak for the whole county, but my focus right now stems from some recommendations that were brought forward by the Commission on Aging. Again, one of those great organizations, great committees within the county that does some really great work. Last year, they focused for the entire year on the issue of housing, and they brought in a housing summit earlier this year. Dr. Elliot Eisenberg came in and gave a presentation on housing, and then we had a meeting with just the commission that talked about some of their findings, what are the barriers, particularly to senior housing, but some of them are applicable to everyone. Planners will tell you, if housing works for young families and seniors, then it works for everyone. So some of those ideas that came out of there, some of the initiatives that have come out of there, one, we're going to be looking at how can we make it easier for seniors to stay in their home. So we're looking at a process for potentially reducing permitting fees and having a streamlining permitting process. If someone's going to be making changes to their home, that's going to make it a little bit more aging friendly. So maybe that's adding some concrete to eliminate the front patio step. Maybe that's widening a door, installing a roll-in shower, adding grab bars in the bathroom. Because some of those little things that just a little improvement can go a long way towards helping someone stay in their home. So that's one thing we're looking at. We're looking at potentially doing something on multifamily housing. Kind of the overarching goal of this was, how can we approach this problem of having enough housing for seniors from multiple angles? So we talked about existing homes, multifamily, looking at other ways that we could do fee reductions for units that are designed for aging in place. So those would be, main floor units or units accessed by an elevator, but probably going to be main floor units, no steps, wider hallways, wider doors, grab bars, really basic things that just a little bit of incentive, I think, would encourage apartment builders, developers to do more of those. As far as other new housing stock, we are coming along with, we're looking at innovative housing, innovative zoning techniques. So things like accessory dwelling units, where are they allowed? Right now, they're not allowed at all in the rural areas. So I think that's something that we definitely want to look at. There are some challenges with the GMA, but certainly they can be allowed if they're attached to the main dwelling. So that could be kind of an accessory dwelling units like the granny flats or mother-in-law quarters. So it's converting an apartment over a garage, converting a basement to be a second dwelling unit.
And the GMA that you just mentioned is the Growth Management Act. And so that is what restricts the ability to do some of this?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's very restrictive in how we can use land, especially in the rural areas. So looking at ADUs, accessory dwelling units, but also cottage housing, which is a way of using land that it's a hybrid between apartments and single family houses, mm-hmm. or townhomes and single family houses. Generally what they look like is smaller homes, not tiny homes, just smaller, 800 to 1400 square feet, 2-bedroom, 1-bath, 3-bedroom, 2-bath. But they are single family detached houses, but are built around like a common courtyard area. They can look like a cottage or not. It's not talking about the style. You know, they can kind of look however you want them to look. But it's a way of using the land that you can get a few more houses in there without just doing the typical high-density townhomes that don't really have a whole lot of visual appeal and where you lose that common space. So rather than everyone having a 5x20 section of backyard, they all share a 40x80, you know, backyard or something like that. So it encourages community as well. But it allows us to build at a much more affordable price point because one of the big drivers for new housing and one of the reasons why we don't get much, you know, smaller single-family houses, most builders build bigger houses because they need that to get the margin. You know, when your land acquisition cost is $120,000 for a lot, you can't put a small house on there and make any money. So they end up building larger houses, and the way the market is right now, they continue to sell. But there's still that demand for people that want, you know, 1,500 square feet or even a little bit smaller, 1,200 square feet, but want something nice. So doing some cottage housing is a way to just provide one more tool for people to use to try and hit that different segment of the market.
So when you say that's something you're working on, what does that mean? What's the process on making that happen look like?
Sure. So the way this started, after the meeting with the Commission on Aging, I put together kind of a white paper of these ideas and brought it to the council and said, here's some things that I think we could work on that I think would have a positive benefit for not just seniors, but for the community as a whole. Do I have your blessing to kind of continue to flesh these ideas out more with staff? Council is supportive of that. So that's what we've been working on right now. There's a work group of staff that's kind of working and bringing ideas to me. I kind of gave them the direction. Here's where I'd like to go. You fill in the gaps of how we get there. And I check in with them on a regular basis. In early August, we're going to be bringing some of these ideas, particularly the ADUs, cottage housing. Then also we're going to look at tiny homes, just more as an informational to see, you know, what are these things? Let's make sure we understand the definitions. So when we're talking about this, we're talking about the same thing. What's allowed right now? What's not allowed right now? And then what could we do? What changes could we make if we decided as a body that we wanted to try and encourage some of these innovative housing? What could we do to try and encourage that? So that work session will happen in August. And, you know, my hope is that out of that, we get support for, well, I'd love to get support for all of these ideas, but hopefully most of these ideas to go forward into, you know, final code language to then come forward in a public hearing.
We talked a bit about Growth Management Act and some of the restrictions that come from the state on the ability to just generally do things. One of the things that is also coming before the county right now is the comp plan, which is the Comprehensive Growth Management Plan, right? You were on the Planning Commission before you were on the County Council, so you had a hand in drafting this comp plan and getting it through to the council. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on with that right now? There's been some controversy about parts of it that got challenged and what the county's pushing back on or doing?
So the comp plan was adopted last June. And as it always is, this happens every time, it was appealed by a number of groups. Kind of on the, just in really broad terms, you have the pro-restriction of land or pro-agriculture group kind of on one side. And then you have the extreme property rights, let us do what we want, you know, whatever we want on our land on the other side. And we got sued from both sides, so it was great. So we had one group saying that you restricted property rights too much, and another group saying you didn't restrict them enough, and the county is in the middle. The group that said you're too restrictive, they lost on every appeal. to the Growth Management Board. So we won all of those cases. The group that said you did too much, they won on a few issues. One of those being the division of ag and forest land. So I'm going to try and... So previously, land that was zoned agriculture had a minimum lot size of 20 acres. Forest land had a minimum lot size of 40 acres. The comp plan cut those in half. So I say, you know what, if you had 20 acres, you can now divide that because now your zoning is 10 acre minimums. I can see your eyes are glazing over, so I'm getting too much into the weeds here. But basically the Growth Management Board said, no, you can't do that, and a few other items.
And so the reason that they would say you can't do that is because they would want to preserve these larger lots for agriculture and forestry and would say that the smaller lots wouldn't make that doable?
Correct. So the Growth Management Act has 14 goals. They are supposed to treat equally and meet all of them. I have a wife and two kids, and I usually can't make the three of them happy all at the same time. So imagine trying to balance 14 equal goals. It's almost impossible. So the Growth Management Board tends to lean towards the protection of agriculture, restriction on the development side as their way in those 14 goals. So they said, you know what, you didn't do enough to protect agriculture, you didn't do enough to prevent sprawl, so we're going to send this part back to you, and you need to make changes and bring changes to us. There's two ways that they can rule against you. One is non-compliant and one is invalidity. And it's kind of like the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony. You know, your non-compliant is like a misdemeanor. It's kind of a slap on the wrist. You're saying, hey, go and fix this. You know, it was you just didn't do it right. And all of ours, with one or two exceptions, were non-compliant. Invalidity is, no, you did very bad thing. That's your felony. And if your comp plan is invalid, you lose eligibility for certain like state grants. So right now, they're floating around in Olympia, there is $10 million potentially in the capital budget for improvements of 10th Avenue, kind of up from, going from like the Whipple Creek area up to the fairgrounds and the amphitheater. And so we want to make sure we're eligible for that $10 million. So we've taken some steps, including a moratorium, saying, you know what, we're not going to allow... Actually, let's clear something up on the moratorium because there's been some misinformation spread about that. The moratorium only prevented things that were newly allowed by the comp plan. Okay, so anything that you could do prior to the comp plan before, you can still do. So the only thing that the moratorium is preventing is in these areas where we said, okay, we're going to go from Ag 20 to Ag 10. That hasn't been officially changed. We're just kind of putting a hold on that until we can finalize, you know, our response to that. So the moratorium has not stopped all rural development. Anything you can do before the last comp plan, you can still do. It's only affecting those areas where the court said you're non-compliant. And the reason why that's important is that the courts can at any time move it from being non-compliant to invalid, saying, you know what, you did a misdemeanor. We gave you a chance to fix it, and you didn't fix it quick enough, so now we're going to call you invalid. And if that were to happen, now that $10 million that's sitting out there for 10th Avenue, we're not eligible for that. So that was the reason for the emergency ordinance. That got a lot of attention. You know, we don't like to do those emergency ordinances, but, you know, for $10 million, it was the right thing to do.
So one of the other issues that came up with the comp plan was about the urban growth boundaries around some of the other small cities in the county.
At the very start of the comprehensive planning process, you start with some population growth projections, and it's an interesting thing. It seems like a relatively minor thing, but it can set you off on the wrong track for the rest of the comp plan. The Office of Financial Management at the state gives you population projections, and they say, here's your low, here's your median, and here's your high. When we got these in 2014, we were coming off of 5 years of like historically low growth, like lowest growth in decades. And so those numbers were correspondingly low. You know, you based on 5 years of depression or of a depressed economy, you're going to come up with these lower numbers. So then you fast forward to the cities expand their housing, or their urban growth boundaries, much of which was going to go into housing. But you have these low growth projections. The people that say, that lean towards overly restrictive, saying, well, look, you have these low population projections. You have enough land. You don't need more land for housing. There's already plenty out there. Now, tell anyone that's trying to buy a house right now, they'll tell you, no, there's not plenty of houses out there. But it was one of those early decisions in 2014 that kind of set the comp plan on a challenging course forward. So that's, you know, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I believe the growth rate that was adopted by the board at that time was around like 1.3%. Mm. And we've actually seen about 2% growth the last couple of years. So, I mean, that's a huge delta. I mean, they missed the mark by 67% if you're looking from 1.3 to 2%. So that was the justification for that. One of the things we can do is go back and do some revisions on the vacant buildable lands model. And now we're getting really technical. But basically, we run this analysis as how much land really is available. But with that, you have to put in a lot of assumptions. You know, how much of that land is going to be consumed by roads, by parks, by schools, by stormwater facilities, to figure out how many houses can you actually build on that. So there's some things in there that we can look at to see, do we have realistic projections? I think we underestimate the amount of land that's lost to infrastructure. The engineers would definitely say, yeah, it's way underestimated. So we can kind of work on some of those formulas, say, you know what, no, we actually don't have enough land, and those expansions were justified.
What is something that just came out of left field entirely for you that you never would have thought would have been a part of being on county council?
I remember watching CVTV last year, and even before I was running, and seeing these people up there, and it's like, wow, I'm actually one of those people now. It's all kind of like that weirdness that I felt like when I, you know, first got to meet a county councilor, because I'm a local government nerd, and that was a big deal to me a couple of years ago. Like, now I am that person that, you know, it's just a little bit surreal.
Now, speaking of CVTV, which is the Clark Vancouver Television, it's the closed circuit sort of county government TV. One of my favorite things to watch on CVTV, since I can't make it to all the public meetings, is the open comment period. I mean, in the service of open government, it's a great opportunity for people to come and express their opinions and talk about what's important to them and lobby for certain issues. And it's a very important part of our open democracy. Now, that said, sometimes you get some very interesting testimony.
You know, if I have a complaint about local government, it's that most people don't care. And so, well, you know, it's always interesting, some of the things that we're accused of and the things that are said about us or things that we've done. I have to give respect to the people that take time out of the day, I mean, especially the frequent flyers. I mean, I care about local government, and I didn't go to every council meeting and testify. So, you know, you take what they say with a grain or two or three of salt sometimes, but, you know, they mean well. They're passionate about what they believe. You know, if you look at what's going on in our national political discourse, there's just this, it bothers me, this view that if someone believes differently than me, then they must have some kind of bad intentions. And I think, you know, we saw that, we just see that so frequently on the national with the political discourse or lack of discourse that happens. So while I may disagree with certain people and agree with others, you know, I have to believe that they're there for good intentions. And, you know, I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. Because when I make decisions that they don't necessarily agree with, you know, I would hope that they'd reciprocate and say, you know what, John wasn't doing that because he hates us. He's doing that because he truly believes that's what's best for Clark County.
Well, I'm glad to hear that answer, and it makes me glad that you're in the position you're in. I also kind of cynically want to say, okay, well, let me check back with you in a year and see if you still feel that way.
Sounds good. We'll do that.
All right. Well, John Blum, County Councilor for Clark County, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Temple.
And that's our show. Thanks again for being here. I'm Temple Lentz, and this has been Hello Vancouver. If you'd like to find out more about Hello Vancouver or check out videos of our live stage show, you can do that at hellovancouver.us. We're produced by High Five Media and look forward to seeing you next time. Thanks.